This week on the Boag World Show, we're joined by Andrew Miller from a leading UK university to talk about his experiences of running a digital team. This week's show is sponsored by Packley and the Digital Project Manager School. Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is confidently said as Paul Boag, and joining me on this week's show is Marcus Lillington and Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you doing?
This is just as well as the last time you asked me when we tried to start the show, and the time after that as well. So there we go. I'm not doing well today. Yes, take three. Take one, I had the inability to say my name. Take two, I forgot to put my headphones on. So we are just doomed. Doomed, I say. So how's life with you? Are you busy, Andrew?
I am. We're just in the middle of ripping out our entire web estate, so it's it seemed like a good idea at the time, but less of a good idea as we're getting into it. But it's
You're
all
not
fun.
Kidding.
It's all good.
Now, is that all kind of getting into like connecting with back-end systems that have been around forever and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, trying to connect to spreadsheets is a great thing.
So just to put this in context for people, Andrew, where do you work and how big is your website?
So I work at the University of Dundee. 4 years ago, when we started all this, our entire web estate was about 500,000 pages. We've got that down to just under 100,000 across the whole entire web estate. But the main corporate site is about 20,000 pages. So, yeah.
And that's the one that you're ripping out and redoing, are you?
Yeah, well, we're trying to consolidate a lot of the other websites back into the main corporate website. So, so a lot of that 100,000 might start to come back in as well. So,
so you're going to migrate? Or are you re-advising? Are you going to be getting rid of a load of content as part of that? Or
I hope so, yes. otherwise, it's going to be a long couple of years. We're kind of reimagining the way we do the website and moving from a kind of less siloed kind of representation of the institution to a more kind of integrated one. Because we used to be feral. You know, we've talked about this in the past. You know, if you had a loud voice, you just went and did whatever you wanted. So we're now kind of in the 21st century, and we're now starting to try and bring all that back in together into something that makes some modicum of sense.
I just love the idea of a feral website. That's a pretty good way of describing many websites I work on. Feral, yeah.
The problem was I was the one that was feral because I'm sorting a lot of my own mistakes at the moment. So. It's all good.
We'll get into that, your mistakes and your journey to where you got to at the moment. But first of all, I have to obligatorily ask Marcus, did you have a nice holiday?
I did. Did you like my time-lapse sunset earlier that I posted on the Boag World Slack channel?
Very nice indeed.
I had to shout at people not to walk in front of me.
No, get out of the way.
I'm sat on the beach at the end of it, holding my phone up for like 20 minutes, thinking this was such a good idea.
It was a terrible idea. You definitely needed a tripod of some description to do
and
that.
And then as soon as it gets to the really good bit at the end, someone decides to go and walk by.
Bastards. Always the way.
But anyway, yes, I highly recommend Sal, Cape Verde for lovely beaches and sunsets and generally being chilled. It was lovely.
Well, I've had a good week too. I've been prototyping. I forgot how much I enjoyed prototyping. It wasn't that long ago I did it, but you know, just to get digging in and messing around with a site is so much fun, especially when it's free from constraints. You know, when you're prototyping to imagine what the future could be rather than worrying about technical legacy and legal and things like that. So I've been having great fun doing that. Andrew's grinning from ear to ear. I can tell. Technical legacy? You don't know what that is, do you?
Not a clue. Not a clue. But yes, I completely appreciate your position on this. It's wonderful.
So I've been having such great time. I've been advising. I'm doing mentorship with a really big multinational company at the moment, and I've been saying to them, look, just step back and dream dreams, imagine what it could be like, prototype, you know, do a prototype where you're not constrained by, it's almost like they're paralyzed, you know, because there are all these constraints around them. But yeah, so that's what I'm doing that for a charity at the moment, which sells it does this kind of you know, buy a donkey kind of thing, you know, where you get a gift, don't you, for someone, where
they deliver you a donkey,
and yeah, they deliver a donkey to your house, you know what I mean. So can I just say, in my defense, I do explain it better than that on the prototype that I'm building. So anyway,
I'm sounds really, like an awesome project.
It is, buy a donkey. Yeah, so yes, there you go. So, yeah, I wrote a post a while back on prototyping that is worth checking out because it's a really good post. He says modestly, it's a long post. Let's put it like that. It's a comprehensive introduction to prototyping. You can get it by going to boag.world/prototyping. So, Andrew, yes. For people that haven't heard about, you know, heard you last time you were on the show, can you kind of give us a bit of a potted history? So we've established that you work at the University of Dundee. You've established that you've been there for a while, from the sounds of it, because you're dealing with your own technical legacy. Tell us about your job. What is it you do?
So I am head of web services at the University of Dundee. I have been at the university for 20 years this year.
Oh, no way.
I did. Now, in my defense, I did the first 4 years of my undergrad degree. So,
okay.
So, you know, kind of still a young thing, or pretending to be a young thing. So I've been here for a long time and kind of been going through different roles and different things, right from kind of, you know, the very low levels up to the heady heights of being head of web services. Which has been fun, which has got its challenges, but it's my dream job as well. This is kind of what I always thought I was going to be doing. So
really? But that's
more or less.
I was going to say, because 20 years ago, it would have been a thing, but not a huge thing, I wouldn't have thought.
No, I mean, so that was 1999 that I started my degree, and the web was just starting to become a thing.
Yeah,
you know, so it wasn't, you know, we had browsers and we had, you know, the internet and whatever else, but it wasn't anywhere near what it is nowadays. And then just reflecting on what my kind of first jobs were, there was nothing like this, you know, back then. So, you know, it was never your main job. It was part of another job that you did this.
Webmaster. That was what.
Webmaster.
Ooh, those were the days.
Seems they were good titles.
My dream job would be restaurant critic, I think.
But don't you think? I often think this, that there's jobs like that, there's a real serious danger that very quickly your passion for food turns into work and it's ruined.
It's absolutely true, yes. People would think I would say being a musician, but no, that ruins being a musician. So
yeah,
you're dead right.
Of course I am. I'm a wise man.
You're always right, Paul. Oh, no, you're not, are you?
So that means you spent... Shut. That means you spent your entire career at the University of Dundee.
Yeah, more or less. I went away for a year and worked at another university.
All right.
I graduated in 2003 and I'd been working at a kind of convenience store, kind of petrol station type thing during my degree. And I'd quit that before... just before I started my last year at university. So I walked in on the last day of my exams and said, you got any jobs going? And they offered me a manager's position in retail, bizarrely. I was a supervisor before then, but they could have offered me a manager's position. So I thought, this is great. I'm going to end up, you know, earning money and, you know, this is going to be wonderful. And the whole degree kind of went out the window for a wee while because, you know, I was earning money and it was cool and I had stuff to spend. And then I kind of didn't really like retail and the kind of people that were managing me weren't terribly nice either. So sent them a rather obnoxious letter saying, telling them where to have their job, as it were.
I can't imagine you doing that. That's really weird.
Yeah, I can't imagine myself doing it either. Yeah, I was kind of marched off the premises and told I was had 2 weeks gardening leave. So then I kind of, you know, looked for other things and ended up at the University of Abertay, which is the other university in Dundee, as a web administrator and kind of bizarrely job shop coordinator, which was a part-time job service for students to try and help them earn money during their degrees, you know. So I then kind of did that for a year or so, did that part-time, and then ended up at Dundee doing the same thing at Dundee but part-time, so having two jobs at the same time.
Right.
And I really quite enjoyed it, and for a while I kind of considered going away from the tech stuff and being more people-focused, because I quite enjoyed speaking to students and helping them and looking at CVs and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And actually kind of helped me later on in my career because, you know, I could look at my own CV critically and figure out what was wrong with it. So that was fine for a wee while. And then I got a position up at one of the big colleges within the university, the College of Life Sciences. And that was just brilliant. It was one of these small IT teams that, if you think about the IT crowd, that was, or the Big Bang Theory, that was kind of like what we were, you know. It was just this brilliant bunch of people, but you know, completely obsessed with tech. And it was those were the times when everything that ran in the browser was the web guy's problem.
Yeah.
You know, because it wasn't the same. I'm talking like I'm an old person. This didn't happen that long ago, but. Everything that ran in the browser was suddenly my problem. So I was suddenly immersed in, you know, doing servers and configuration and development and, you know, having to manage, you know, the entire life cycle of stuff. So that was fine. I was the only web guy at that point. So over the years, I kind of expanded my role and expanded my team to being something a lot bigger. We started to take over different things. And then the university restructured. Probably 4 years ago now, and I became head of web services. Was offered the position, and I took it. And now this is my dream job. So I miss development, though. I miss designing and developing and writing code and sitting configuring servers. And there are days where you wish you could just go back to those days and tinker around. And you know, I now manage people that do cool stuff when I used to do cool stuff.
But that's the curse of anyone that is successful in their career, isn't it? Eventually, you end up not doing what it is you love doing.
End up in management, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But, of course, you can have a much bigger impact overall on, you know, on the direction things are going. And that's kind of satisfying. It's satisfying in a different way, isn't it? It changes, I guess.
So, it is, you know, so you can have the impact. And actually... you had a big impact in my career. I'm going to give you a big head now, but...
Good. That's what I like, especially with Marcus listening. Carry on.
I'm not getting paid for this, I should say. I remember hearing you speaking at an IWMW event in 2013 about kind of digital transformation and all that was entailed by that. And I went from being this kind of really techie person to actually going... oh, there's a human element to this, and we could do this, we could do that, and we could do the next thing. And that kind of focused my thoughts, actually, and what I wanted to do. And kind of helped me go, actually, I want to get into management, I want to change things, I want to make things better, I want to, you know, started sending all these things to senior people in the university saying, we should do this, we should do that, and here's this cool guy that says this, and, you know. So, yeah. So it's your fault, really, to be honest. Then,
until you said cool guy. That was one of Paul's fire and brimstone talks, if I remember rightly, trying to get everyone in the room to kind of grab the whatever you grab and you know, go back to their various universities or institutions and do something. You actually did it. So Paul,
I did, yeah.
you should feel
it's a well
good.
Done, Paul. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, it's a lot easier to tell people to go and do it than it is to go and do it. You know, I had the easy bit, didn't I? Really, I sound humbled. We must stop that. Yes, it's all down to me. There we go. But what I find quite remarkable, really, Andrew, is that, you know, you spent pretty much your entire career in one organization, yet you seem less institutionalized, if you know what I mean, than many people that have only been there a few years. You know, when we worked together, I never got from you that, oh, well, we tried that, but it didn't work, or we, you know, or, oh, you'll never get away with doing that here. It was always much more positive, much more we can bring about change. Is that a reflection on the institution, or is it a reflection on you, or, you know, where does that come from? Because a lot of people have that kind of crushed out of them, especially in an organization like a university.
Yeah, I'm going to be completely humble and say, of course, it was all about me. I mean, it was about the institution as well. I mean, I love Dundee. I mean, I did my degree here, so I've kind of been on both sides of the table. But I've had opportunities to go elsewhere, and I've you know, agencies and kind of private companies. And every time I've kind of gone for the interview, and you've kind of sat there and you've kind of listened, and I've always just been. I like the idea of being part of something that's doing good, you know, that's kind of, you know, strapline's transforming lives, and that kind of sounds a bit kind of strange sometimes, but when you speak to the academics and you speak to people and you see what they're doing, and even speaking to students and understand what they're doing with their lives, actually it's not a bad place to work. And, you know, I get quite a lot of pride out of saying that I work for the University of Dundee and I enjoy it. And there are days when you go, oh, you know, I just can't be bothered with this and just want to kind of chuck it all in. But the kind of good days outweigh the bad days. And so I've always just been dragged back. So I kind of, reflecting now that it's been 20 years that I've been here in one capacity or the other, you kind of think, should I be moving on? I'm enjoying myself. I like it. Yeah. I like people, like the work. You know, let's just keep cracking on and doing stuff.
So, but Paul has asked a good question in Crowdcast, where he said, you know, how do you maintain perspective when working within one organization for so long? Are you fed from the outside in some way, or, you know, how do you get that fresh perspective that you need in order to do a job like you're doing?
I mean, I listen to a lot of, you know, like some podcasts like this. I listen to lots of different perspectives. I try not to get too... I've learned over the years not to take things too personally and not to get kind of crushed down, and always try to look for a better way of doing things. And I think that also kind of comes from my family as well. They were kind of a family that kind of looked at different ways of doing things. And, you know, so there's kind of outside perspectives on that as well. And I'm involved in other things outside of the university, and that gives you lots of ideas as well. And I like going and speaking to people and, you know, like, what is it you do and what is it you do? Mm-hmm. And also within the university, I try to get out of the office quite a bit and actually go and speak to the schools and the directorates and the people who are having the problems, and actually try to empathise with them and go, yeah, I can understand why you're saying this to me because of what you've now told me.
Yeah.
I think when you sit in an office all the time, you're very used to just going, oh, you know, why am I getting all these requests? In fact, it's dead funny. I was looking through old emails yesterday and came across an email I had sent to what was essentially my predecessor about 10 years ago, asking for things that I'm now saying no to. people who are asking the same questions. So a little bit of kind of retrospective sometimes helps to keep you humble and keep you straight.
Also, I mean, there is actually a very strong higher education web community out there. You know, Andrew's already mentioned IWMW, which is a superb conference that I'll link to in the show notes. But also within Scotland as well, the Scottish universities, you all talk to one another, don't you? Meet up every now and again. And that must help, I'm guessing.
We do. It's called Scottish Web Folk. And it's done by... brilliant guy up in the Highlands and Islands University, Duncan Ireland. And he keeps us all kind of meeting and talking, and we arrange, I think it's like quarterly, we get together and chat about the things that are affecting us, things that are coming up. And this is UK-wide, especially in terms of the IWMW community. We're not terribly precious about what we do. You know, we will have a good moan, but we'll give each other solutions. And it's a huge support, especially when you hear what other people are going through and having to cope with. You look back at your own institution and go, actually, this is not as bad as what other people are going through. We're very, very fortunate in the support we've had. It could have been so much worse.
That reminds me.
So much worse.
We came back from an IWMW a couple of years ago, maybe, something like that, and I made the comment of something along the lines of, isn't it brilliant to see the HE community taking strides forward, they're way ahead of industry, or something like that. And yeah. I got absolutely slammed for it. Sort of like, that might really? Be the case for a small group, but we're still struggling was the message. I mean, that was a few years ago, but yeah. So
yeah. And it is true. It is all over the map. I've just been working with another Scottish institution. I pick my words very carefully here. And they're crippled. They cannot. It's one of the rare mentorship relationships that I've done where I was unable to make progress with them. You know, it was just a dead end. So yeah, there are pockets of that, but I think that is declining. I think, you know, like any sector, and I work in a lot of different sectors, and you know, I think higher education in some ways is more progressive than many other sectors. Surprisingly, even the corporate sector, even, you know, even organizations like I worked with another a retailer, a fashion retailer, right? Multinational. And their e-commerce and their ways of working and their from a digital transformation perspective, they are leagues behind, you know, somewhere like Dundee. So it entirely depends. The commercial sector throw more money at it, but it doesn't mean they're further along the line of digital transformation. There's a huge difference, you know?
Yeah.
So it is fascinating.
Yeah, I was going to say we've just kind of done a big tender exercise where we've kind of, you know, brought in a new CMS. As part of that, I was looking at an agency that we can work with, and it was amazing going through that process about some where we were going to have to teach them how to do stuff. And you always assume when you're sitting in that kind of higher education context that, you know, you don't know anything and you're no good. And you know, we saw some that we thought, we can't work with you because we're going to have to upskill you to the stage where we're at before we can actually get you to move on. So we wanted an agency that was going to push us rather than us having to push them. So,
yeah, absolutely. Let's pause just for a minute because I want to talk about the Digital Project Management School. In fact, what I want to talk about is a charity that I've been working with, which is called the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Check them out, actually. They work in this idea of a circular economy, the idea of that, you know, we can have an economy that is more friendly to the people and the world and stuff like that. So they're a really interesting charity. And what is so fascinating about working with them is that they're growing and they're expanding and they're doing all this kind of stuff. And they're desperately trying to recruit a digital product manager, and just the first of numerous ones. They want to set up a hub and spoke model where they have digital project managers embedded in different parts of the charity, right? They are having such problems recruiting. I ought to put a link to the job description really in the show notes, because they really are having struggle recruiting, because finding good people is really, really hard. And that is why this does tie in to the sponsor, which is the Digital Project Manager School. And this is why I want to feature things like Digital Project Manager, because they train people that can do these jobs that are so desperately needed. And you talk to anybody who runs any kind of digital team, and there is a real need for good people with digital project manager skills. And very few of us actually have ever had any training in this area. And that's exactly what the Digital Project Manager School does. So they launched a course last year called Mastering Digital Project Management, which they've received some superb feedback from. It's really very much pioneering in how digital project management is taught, you know, because it's different, isn't it, to traditional project management. I'm really glad to see that this is being taught in its in that kind of unique way. The course is completely online. It's got a 7-week curriculum. It covers everything from broad topics like project methodologies and leadership qualities, kind of thing you need if you're going to be leading a digital team like Andrew is. And all the way through to doing that kind of specific daily task like estimating projects, handling budgets, writing briefs, dealing with unexpected challenges from stakeholders, and a whole lot more. The next course is starting on February the 4th, so you'll need to hurry by the time this podcast comes out. And you can find out more about it.
February the 4th?
No, April? That can't be right, can it? April. I mean April. It's beginning of April somewhere. Thank you for pulling me up on that, Marcus. You can find out more by going to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/BOAG World. So, Andrew, talking of digital project management and leading teams and that kind of stuff, how would you describe what your role encompasses?
It's a difficult one. I mean, head of web services, it sounds like you're a cleaner dusting off cobwebs or, you know, and I guess how I explain it depends on how long I want the conversation to last and whether I want to come away with any work at the end of it. Because when you say, you know, I mean, I could say I design websites, which is a complete lie nowadays. I don't ever get my hands on actual HTML and CSS. But you always get somebody going, oh, could you build me a website for such and such?
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes I just say I'm an IT manager, mm-hmm. especially with insurance companies, bizarrely, when they ask you what your occupation is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Web just seems to be this anonymous. I can't say that word.
It seems to be a strange thing.
Yeah. No. So I just say I'm an IT manager when I'm speaking to insurance companies just to try and, you know, sometimes I say I'm in digital marketing. Again, it depends on who you speak to. Most of the times I just say that I'm in charge of Dundee Uni's website and I have all the responsibilities around about that, and I get all the grief and all the complaints and all the accolades and, you know, whatever else in relation to that. So I think and it's strange, now I'm a manager, I'm finding that a lot of the skills I had with design and development and all this kind of stuff have started to wane a wee bit. Still understand the principles and still understand all that stuff behind it, but when you just say you're a manager, it doesn't sound quite as cool as a webmaster as it used to.
No.
So yeah, I think that's how I explain it.
So what does it for us who are a little more informed than maybe an insurance company, what does your role actually encompass? What do you do on a, you know, daily basis? Say an average day.
An average day, so I normally get into the office about 8:30, and the first hour is spent with emails. I have a kind of routine where I do a first pass and just kind of separate all the wheat from the chaff and, you know, figure out what's actually important. And then I'll kind of reply to the important ones first of all. And very often I'll just leave ones that I think, don't have time to answer that one just now, or that's going to require a bit of thought, or, you know, actually I need to go and speak to someone about that. And then, so that's about the first hour. I go through my task list. I used to be able to keep everything in my head, and I don't know if it's something to do with age, but I just cannot keep everything in my head now. So I use task lists every day. You know, I have a task list for, I use Microsoft To Do or something like that. I have a task list for every person that I, you know, each one of my direct reports, my managers and other key people. So when I go about the day, I can type stuff up and say, I need to speak to you about that and whatever else. And then as part of the big web project, we have everything kind of planned out in a kind of like Trello type thing where we go through that and figure out where we are. And then 9:30 every morning, we have a stand up with our digital agency down south. where we tell them what we've done, they tell us what they've done, and figure out what we're doing for the day. And then the rest of the day is, it's kind of split between meetings and doing some actual work, sitting at a computer, which some days you wish you could just spend the whole day sitting at a computer rather than attending meetings. Although the days when you do get to sit at your computer doing stuff, you wish you had a couple of meetings to break up the day.
To break it up, yeah.
To break it up, the monotony. But most of my work nowadays is about speaking to people and bringing people together and trying to make decisions. And universities are strange places that rule by consensus rather than by a top-down approach. So you would think that you could go to the senior person and go, you know, can you make a decision on this? And they'll make a decision on it, but you'll get another 10 people who will come back at you and say, no, no, that's the wrong decision because of X, Y, and Z. And you kind of have to go back to the start. So a large percentage of my time is going and speaking to people and trying to convince them that we're doing the right thing and get them on board and try to get them to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. Some people get it straight away. Other people, it's a bit more of a longer process to explain what user experience is and, you know, interface design and why we're doing user needs. And, well, I've given you your user needs. Why do you need to go and ask other people what your user needs are? So that is really pretty much, you know, 90% of my time going out and doing presentations and all this kind of stuff.
Do you feel that people are getting it more now? Do you feel that your colleagues kind of understand that you're not what your job title says, which is you're not just a service department that delivers on whatever random crap they want to produce? Do they understand that you, as a team, you know, are providing a leadership role in digital?
I think it's getting there. We kind of moved out of IT into marketing about kind of 4 years ago, which has really helped us try to sell that story, because marketing was really suffering from a similar thing, that they were seen as the people who did the posters and the leaflets. Yeah. And that's what they did. So we've had a kind of, you know, joint attack on the university to try and get people to understand that we are partners in trying to help them to sell their products. There are still people that you get, I mean, I get random phone calls saying, you're head of web service, right? I've been on the phone to IT and they said we can do this. Can you now just make it happen? It's like, I'm not part of IT. they still think we're part of it and it's all this. So some people get it and some people are completely on board. Some people, the internet is just this foreign thing. Trying to get academics to think about what will people actually be searching for when they're looking for your course. And that's kind of what you should call your course so that it kind of, you know, resonates with the market. It's just like, you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall sometimes. And then other academics completely get it. And it's a joy sometimes to find an academic who is, you know, ahead of you on this game.
Sorry, Marcus, carry on.
No, I was going to say, I mean, you know, your title is Web Services Manager, which, yeah, is very dry, isn't it? But it seems like I remember, Paul, you coined the term digital evangelist a few years ago. It sounds like that's your role more than anything else. You're going out having to persuade people either to part with money for a project or to do a project right. You're not really necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's sort of, yes, people report to you and you've got projects going, but really your job is to go and kind of evangelize. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, because it's a hearts and minds thing sometimes. Sometimes it's not about the business case that you put forward. It's about getting to the key people and actually convincing them. I remember when I did the interview for this job, the feedback I got was that I was almost evangelical in my presentation. I think that's absolutely right. You have to convince the hearts and the minds that this is the right way to do things. And that's, you know, you have to be a bit charismatic in how you present things and you have to take people with you. It's not always easy, depending on the situations you're going in. You have to be prepared for backlash sometimes, but Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, Marcus.
That's very interesting that you said there. It's not always about the business case or the logic. It's about winning hearts and minds. And I think that is something that is seriously underestimated in our sector. We have this kind of we have this presumption that if we set out a logical argument and, you know, it's all so clear and it makes sense, then everybody should just fall in line and do what we want them to do. And the world doesn't work like that. You know, people don't make decisions like that in any organization, and especially not universities. And it's essentially, you're a salesman, really, you know, in what you have to do. I mean, I always go back to that brilliant Jared Spall article where he wrote, which was entitled "Why I Can't Convince an Executive to Invest in UX and Neither Can You." And the premise of the article is, I've been doing this for 20 plus years. I've never managed to convince an executive of anything. All I can do is try and frame it around something they're already convinced of. You know, if they want to reduce costs, and I talk about how user experience design can reduce organizational costs. If they want to increase market share, I talk about how it can increase market share. And it's not always just about being logical or presenting an argument. You know, like you take an academic that, you know, you could talk about using the terms that users search on, and like you say, they don't give a monkey's ass because they don't really care about students. Half of the academics, they just want to do their research.
Sweeping and, statements know. By Paul Boeing.
I said half of the academics. Yeah, the other half will do that. But there are some academics. Yeah, there are some academics that are there for research, and actually the teaching is something that they're not as interested in. That's
they're
fair enough
to do. Yes,
yeah, and you know, that's fair enough, you know. So in which case you've got to frame the whole of the, you know, naming the things right and the terms, you know, as much about, you know, the benefit that it will provide them in terms of their exposure and peer review and, you know, all of those kinds of things, the things they already care about. So, yeah, you're entirely right. It's a hearts and minds exercise. Definitely.
Well, you have to make it about, it has to be something they care about. I remember when we started the pitch for the, you know, for the big investment bid, we went in and said, you know, got 500,000 web pages we need to sort out. And they go, well, okay, is that a lot? Is that a little? And
yeah.
You then say, well, if I put one person on it for 10 minutes, it's going to take me 53 years to get through it all. And they then start to sit up and go, oh, actually, I see the scale of the problem here. And you then got that little hook to bring them in, and they then go, okay, let's listen to what this person's saying. But I remember another senior academic sitting in front of him, showing him data and showing him analytics, and it contradicted his view of how things should be done. And he says, well, he says, you can make analytics do anything. Yeah. And this was a senior academic that spent his life with data, doing analytics, you know, and completely disregarding it. So it's a difficult job sometimes.
And well, you get into all kinds of, sorry, Marcus, you get into all kinds of psychological stuff there as well, around, you know, how the academic would presume that he was a superior to you within the organization rather than a peer, and so you're supposed to just fall in line with him. And also, let's be honest, these guys argue for a living. That's what they do, you know. So it is a tough environment, you know, other than when Marcus went through a period of working with lawyers. I don't think you can get much worse than dealing with academics, really. You know, they're right up there. Sorry, Marcus, you were going to say something.
Well, we're currently working with a law school. Imagine what those
are. There you go.
Like.
They're pretty fun.
Yeah, they are good fun. Generally speaking, what I've found over the years, and I think this is because I'm an external consultant, is everyone agrees with me. Yes, that makes absolute sense. That's how we're going to do it going forward. And then you have to kind of, like, when you're kind of reporting back at the end of it, you have to say, right, we need to get some of this down in policy, you know, and actually write it down that you might agree in principle about kind of, you know, put users first, et cetera, all the things we discussed. But what that could actually mean, and provide examples that, yes, your little project that you think is the most important thing in the world needs to go through the same questions that you would any other project. All the stuff you've just agreed to basically applies to you as well. And you have to hammer that home. I'm currently writing that at the moment for the law school. You've got to have stuff to support that, because I found that people do agree with it.
And you're really interesting you say that. I actually tweeted only this morning. I think it was this morning, or it might be in my buffer queue. I tweeted, that sometimes the best way of defining things like that is to define what you're not going to do, right? Mm. So, yes, we're going to put the user first, which means we are not going to put ... first, you know?
Yeah.
You've got to show them the cost. Yes, if you want them to actually agree with it. But also, policies are great. Policies are power, because policies aren't personal. If you write things in policy, people kind of just fall in line a lot easier. At least that's my experience.
Yeah. So, you say, academics are good at arguing with policy and finding caveats to policy. We once had a policy or a thing where we said you can only have, I think it was like 4 sentences on your course page. But then the English course came back with every comma and semicolon and whatever else. And it ended up as big as it was before. So, that's just life.
But you do a type of this, don't you? Because you do a variation on the digital triage approach. Then that's an example of a kind of policy, is it not?
Digital triage?
Oh, I'm getting... No, I'm entirely
blue. Is that me? We should do that.
So I must be I've obviously got you utterly confused with one of the other 30 higher education institutions I work with, so forgive me for that.
I think there was. In fact, I think there was somebody at IWMW was doing digital triage. Who was it?
Somebody, it's something I made up at one point. But it's essentially a way of organizing projects, the order you do projects, using a point system rather than whoever shouts the loudest. I'm sure you've got some variation of that where you have a list of criteria by which you decide which projects go first. You said at the beginning that you have moved away from that, who shouts the loudest. What system do you use then? I'm interested.
Whoever provides me with chocolate, generally.
Yeah.
No, we tend to it's a combination of business requirements. So there are some areas that naturally bring in higher amounts of cash than other places, and they generally get put to the top of the list. If there's institutional targets to be met, we tend to look at that. We tend to work with our individual schools and directorates early on in the planning process to say, right, what are your priorities? And we can then start to look at that across the piece and go, right, we can do that and that and that. We can't do that. We tend to try and get them all together so that they can we can have a kind of bird's eye view to say, well, we could do that and that's going to solve 9 problems just by doing that bit. So it varies. We did try to come up with a kind of points-based system, but it was really difficult trying to get good data out of the institution. You say, how much money are you going to bring in? I'm going to bring in this amount of money. And you go, well, where's that data coming from? Well, I think I can get this amount of money.
Mm. Yeah, can I go off on a tangent a minute? It is slightly relevant. You mentioned the English course with the sentence and using all of the commas and semicolons, etc. I'm reading a book called A Gentleman in Moscow at the moment, which is one of the most beautifully written books I've ever read. And it reminded me of a sentence which was, here indeed was a formidable sentence, one that was on intimate terms with a comma and that held the period in healthy disregard. Beautiful. Read that book. It's gorgeous. Anyway.
There's So one thing that I wanted to ask you, Andrew, was this idea of how our, you said earlier about you were looking back through old emails and you saw an email where you were asking for the very things that you're now saying no to. It got me thinking about your role and how you learn as you go through your career. I'm really interested. If you could go back and talk to yourself, to that person that 4 years ago got the role of web services manager, what advice would you give them now you've kind of gone through what you've gone through?
run.
Get a job in an agency.
I think I would encourage myself to trust my instincts a bit more, because I've realised that the things I tend to second guess myself a lot and not trust what I'm saying. And we've talked about kind of imposter syndrome before and all that kind of entails. And I think I could possibly have made a wee bit more progress if I'd stuck to my guns, because I've tended to find the things that I've said, first of all, it's been argued against, and then we've come back to it in the future and accepted that that's what we should do. And you think, I said that 18 months ago, and, you know, it was thrown out. So I think, you know, trusting my instincts a bit more, and also asking for more than you think you'll get. I've always been quite conservative, because, you know, again, I second guess myself and say, well, I'll ask for that, but actually I'll not get that because of X, Y, and Z, so I better ask for this and I might get that. Whereas actually, you know, just go in big and then work down from that, and you'll generally get what you wanted in the first place just by kind of putting more than you thought you were going to get. Although I have been surprised as well that, you know, I've been given that what I want, what I asked for, which is, you know, I've obviously made a good case for it.
Yeah, cool. I mean, it's really that whole thing of second guessing yourself is really tricky, because you know, you could end up having the opposite problem where you swing the other way, and you become too dogmatic over stuff when you actually need to back off. So it is something that you only really learn via trial and error. Going back to that, the other thing that you said about you know, you say something and then 18 months later it's adopted. Do you think there's a degree where that's kind of inevitable to some extent, that sometimes an idea takes time to bed in, or it wasn't the right time for the idea? The organization wasn't ready for the idea yet. Do you think that's has been the case in the past?
I think so. I've often found that if you try to convince people against their will, they'll still keep the same opinion, you know, and you have to give the idea time to settle and mature and kind of roll around in their heads, and you just have to keep plugging away at it. And when I think back 20 years to the stuff, well, not 20 years, but maybe 10 years when I was writing all these kind of things, it's taken, you know, 10 years for me to get into a position where it's possible. And I've said this before, the things that we're doing now wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. And that's nothing to do with me. That's just the maturity of the organisation has got to a stage where actually we accept that these things are important and we understand them a bit more, and, you know, we've got the reputation to be able to sustain them. So it takes a while. Sometimes you can convince people just by giving a good presentation, you know, something that kind of pulls at the heartstrings. Other times you need to go and do it and leave it with them and just accept that, you know, you might not have won it that day, but you'll come back to it in the future and it'll be more relevant.
That's also mine. There's something in there of having the fact that you've been there for so long, that you take, you know, you take the long view with an institution like that. That sometimes, you know, you went back earlier, we were talking about how some higher education institutions are really struggling and they haven't made progress and all the rest of it. And I think sometimes that can be good. People come in, they get frustrated by the situation and then move on. And there's not that consistency of push, gentle push, 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 keep pushing year in, year out. And actually, there's something to be said for the fact that you've been there so long and you've been constantly pushing at that, that maybe you have actually had a bigger impact on the institution than maybe you think you have, that you have been instrumental in moving it to that place. Or am I giving you too much credit?
Could never do that, Paul. That's entirely correct. No, I think you're right. I think you have experience. I think having sat within lots of different areas in the university, I'm able to look at all the problems and understand. I can understand why you're asking for this. And I don't think this is the right thing for you. And here's the reason why I don't think it's the right thing for you. And you can talk with some knowledge of the problems that they're going through. And once they realise that you're actually empathising with them,
yeah,
the kind of barriers come down a wee bit, and you can actually have an honest one-to-one conversation. And I'm now kind of poacher turned gamekeeper, where, as I say, you know, I'm starting to fix a lot of my mistakes, but because I've got those contacts back in those areas where, you know, I'm trying to make changes, they tend, I'm not saying they fully trust me, but it's an easier sell to make than somebody who's coming fresh, who's got no higher education experience, or, you know, no experience with Dundee. And we've seen that with other areas of the university where very, very good people have been brought in who are cracking an industry, or, you know, private sector, whatever else, no experience of higher education or Dundee in general, and who have just got completely frustrated that they can't move things on at the pace they want to do, and they disappear, and you're back to stage one, you know, within a couple of years' time. So, I like to think that my grey hairs count for something.
Yeah, and I do think that's the case. You're right. I mean, I've seen people like people that have come from somewhere like the Government Digital Service, and they think they're going to sweep in and do what's happened at the Government Digital Service and make it all different, you know, make big changes. But in truth, every organization is different. You know, you can't make the presumption that what you did in another organization is going to transplant, even if it's in the same sector, is going to transplant into a different situation. Because culturally every organization is different. And that's something that I've had to learn as an outside consultant, is not just to presume that when I go into an organization, oh, I'll do what I did in the other three universities I worked with or whatever else. You can't do that, which is, it's a shame, really. It'd make life a lot easier if you just could.
It would do, yeah.
So, just to wrap up, one last question before we finish, which is, what do you see as being the future of your role and maybe the role of your team? How would you like it to change, or how do you think it'll evolve?
That's an interesting one, because I think when I came into this job, you think web is this future-looking thing and think something that's going to be around for ages. Mm. And now that I'm a bit long in the tooth, you think, actually, the sector is changing so quickly. We're not going to be looking at browsers for terribly much longer. You know, it's going to be into voice, and so I think as a team, and certainly as myself, I'm kind of resigning myself to the fact that things are going to change, and I'm not going to be doing my job as it is now is not going to be the same as it is in 5 years' time. I can almost guarantee it. Even just, you know, different technologies or different ways of working, it's going to be different. I think that the challenge for us is finding people who are willing to change, and who have that ability to change as well. You know, and that, you know, it will be different, and things will move on, and that's just the nature of the job. Whereas we in university, sometimes we get people who just want to come in and do the 9 to 5, and that's until retirement, and that's just not the sector we're in. And even wider higher education sector, that's just not the way it's working anymore.
You've got change from all angles as well, because not only do you have to keep pace with the change of digital, the whole of higher education has gone through this major upheaval, you know, as it's become a more of a consumer-led sector, and, you know, it's about bums on seats and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, there's a lot coming at you, isn't there, really?
Yeah, I mean, the sector of what it was 20 years ago, fairly unregulated, to what it is now, it's just light years of difference. And then all the funding changes that are happening as well, we're necessarily having to force ourselves to change. I think there's disruption coming in the market in the not too distant future, if it's not here already. I think if we're not, I think we're going to be pushed to try and keep up with that. I think we are, as an organisation, kind of ready for that. But that's going to be difficult from a people aspect of it. Technology comes and technology goes, and you get implementers and it works. But it's the people and culture aspect of that that's going to be the tricky bit. And I think that's where more of my job is going to be based, that trying to allay people's fears and trying to help them come along on that journey. Whereas in the past, they would just have shut down and just gone, this is not for me, I'm not going to do it, go away, and I don't want to see you again.
Yeah. So on that cheerful note.
But it's good. It's a good job.
Yeah, it is. Well, the future, look to the future. Accepting change, it's important.
Oh, it is massively important. Before we wrap up today's show, I just want to talk about our second sponsor, which is Packly. For those of you who are unfortunate enough to have clients like universities, when you're a freelancer or an agency or a small business, and you have to deal with a blooming university procurement department and the legal department, trust me, I feel your pain. And you'll get these contracts through, right? Or these purchase orders and, you know, terms and conditions and all of this kind of stuff from universities. And you look at this stuff and you go, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm signing my life away here. I don't know. I don't understand it. Packly is a tool that can help you. It's the first easy, accessible AI-based contract review tool aimed at people like us, people, freelancers, small agency owners, consultants, helping you to understand those contracts that you get through. Basically, all you do is you upload the contract and almost instantly you'll receive a report which essentially highlights anything unusual in the report, anything that looks maybe a bit risky or a bit unusual. It will flag those. Like Marcus, once didn't Headscape we get a university contract that said we had to deliver the website on a truck?
Not sure it was well, it might have been. We definitely did have that one. I think that might have been a government agency.
Oh, is it a government agency? Just brilliant.
It's through via the loading bay doors or something like that.
I wouldn't put it past a university, to be honest. University.
It's just so fantastic. Anyway, you could get 2 reviews a month for free. You can sign up now and review a contract in a matter of seconds. It's all automated. You can, if you use the our offer code, then you'll get 30% off the lifetime of the paid plan. So the offer code is, unsurprisingly, BOAG World. But you can give it a try for free first. You can use the link, which is pac.sg/BOAG World. And that will take you there. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
Dave Smith on the Slack channel posted this, and it did make me titter. I used to play the triangle in a reggae band. I had to give it up because it was just one ting after another.
Oh, that is terrible. Well done, Dave. Thank you for that one.
Awesome.
So, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And
thanks for having me.
And good luck with the massive, you know, rebuild.
You're brave. I may need it.
You will need it. That is pretty intense. But it's the right thing to do. Sooner or later, you have to go, do you know what? You know, I'm not a fan of website redesigns, but you need a firm foundation from which to build, don't you? So every now and again, it has to be done. So next week, we have Aaron Walters joining us again on the show. It's been a while since he's been on. He's currently working for Envision as an evangelist, going back to Marcus's term earlier. He's doing all the education stuff on Envision. And again, you know, what the hell does that mean? What's it mean to be an evangelist? So we're going to find out next week when he joins us. But until then, thanks for listening and goodbye. Awesome. Oh, great stuff. Sorry, Lewis, we didn't do your question about 9 to 5, but you know, eventually you got to wrap the show up. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us in the room. Andrew, can you pop us through the audio from that you recorded today? Drop it in Dropbox or somewhere like that and just fling it at me and Marcus. Is that right?
Yep, will do.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thank you very much. That was brilliant. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, it's always nice. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Yep. Bye. Cheers. See you later.
Bye. Bye.